We're on.
Hello. Hi, this is...
Stop it!
But I haven't come up with a title, that's why. This is yet our third...
Indigenous IG.
This is our third session of Voicing Indigeneity, which we will title... Lord of...
Indigenous. Lord of the Indigenous.
Lord of the Dead.
Our Indigenous of the Ring.
Yeah, Indigenous of the Ring.
What? Oh, Waddell, if you keep hitting the table. Oh,
sorry.
Okay, we just started and now Madel's already in trouble.
So, this is Madel and I am introducing this third segment of Voicing Indigeneity. And what we've decided to share with everybody today is a little bit about ourselves in terms of how and perhaps why we decided to join the Department of Ethnic Studies at UC San Diego. So, oh, our friend Angela is going to lead us off and talk about her experience.
Okay, I was even thinking, like, about why I do my work in ethnic studies, you know? Because certainly there are, like, departments to that focus on Native American studies. And it's such a struggle, which I don't think I thought it was a struggle before I came here because I had, like, a mentor in Brian Klopotek at University of Oregon, Sherry Hundorf. I had my family and close... friends who were Native around, and so but also as an undergrad you don't do so much of your own research, and so it doesn't come up as much, although when I did start I was a McNair scholar at the University of Oregon, and so I got to do my own research. And from the moment I started doing what I wanted to do, I started writing from North Portland, where I'm from, and what was my project called? When General Canby Died, an Autoethnography of a Native American Family. And brought for a 20-page paper. But I was talking about how I thought about being Indian when I was a kid and how all the books that I looked at about our tribe and the Modoc War of 1873, like it all stops with the end of the war. But obviously, you know, there... our family went on, and of course the tribe. But when I was a kid, the tribe had been terminated in the 50s, and so even that was like belonging to a tribe that didn't exist. I mean, there's so much to write about when you come from a place like that. It's like, where are you going to start? Anyway, but they were, what do they call it, restored? No, oh, this is bad that I don't know this word. You know when they
yeah, isn't it restored?
Okay, in 1987, the Klamath tribes. Okay. So they're not terminated anymore. So why ethnic studies? Well, I thought I might want to. I always know I like to write, so I thought I might want to do journalism. That didn't even last a whole term. And then I thought, hey, there's Indians and Anthro. So if you go to Anthro, at least somebody will have your back. But it was so brutal. Sitting there with their skulls and shit. I mean, oh, I was like, gotta go. I could barely keep my temper. So then I went to comparative literature because they were talking about race and you could read books. But what? How many languages do you have to learn to do that? Like two, three? And I was starting this project for McNair and I went to ethnic studies because somebody said, well, Sherry Hundorf's Native, and I needed a Native professor to say yes to me, to just tell me that my idea was good, that I had a good idea. And so I went to talk to Sherry. She was the head of the ethnic studies. It's not a department at U of O, it's a program at the time. And she's in English there. And she was so cool. And I was like, how do I get into this program? How do I walk through the door here? Because this is where I need to be. And that was my junior year. And then when I was looking at grad schools, I definitely was thinking about American studies programs, but oh, I guess I'm kind of a true believer, and I love the political aspect of being an ethnic studies scholar. I really feel like you put your stuff on the street in ethnic studies. You're not writing about race from history or anthro. You don't have like some, you don't have some legitimate degree to back you up. Like, your degree is political. It's in ethnic studies. And yeah, there's enough of some, I wanted to bring that. So, and also I was, I don't know, I had my concerns. And I came to UCSD for kind of funny reasons now that I mean, when I think about the fog I was in my senior year as an undergrad looking for a program, I didn't know what was going on. I finally got in the tub and I said, when I get out of this bath, I will know where I'm going. And Ross Frank, who was recruiting me like with many phone calls, was like, it seems like whoever talks to you last, that's where you're going. So I already told him I'm not coming. I told him I'm coming. I'm not coming. USC thought I was coming. Berkeley thought I was coming. I was going everywhere. But I wasn't. And then so I had to call everybody up and say, I'm not coming to your school. Because it's true, Ross was the last person to talk to me on the phone.
Hey.
He got to me last. But I really thought that what they sold me on was their rigorous intellectual rigorousness of the program, because I thought, you know, being a Native intellectual, wanting to write about my family, I'm gonna take hits, because I do think that scholarship should be invested with emotion, you know, and I thought I need the best training I can get, and I did think that they were doing that here, I also succeeded in a program that that was small and had intensive mentorship, and UCSD offered that, and I have certainly gotten that at UCSD. I mean, Ross Frank has been. I was thinking yesterday, like, where would I be if anything happened to him? Seriously, he needs to watch his health
so that you can stick around, right?
Well, because I mean, seriously, like, we work closely together, and so I wouldn't have anyone to do my work with. So that's all I have.
Madame, you're next.
Go ahead. I can't. I'm still thinking.
Okay, wait. So I guess I'll go then.
Oh, and did I say I was Angie Merrill?
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't know if we introduced ourselves this
That's
time.
Right.
No, we didn't.
We
okay.
Didn't.
Okay, so go ahead and introduce yourself, and then.
Oh, all right, you guys. And since I'm still talking, we also were thinking we'd like you to get to know us a little better in this podcast. And so I'm a single mom. I'm 41, which I know, but you know what? I think I'm going to grow out my hair, so I'm just going to go ahead and own it. So if you log on to our blog at www.voicingindigeneity.blogspot.com and you see a gray-haired, old, fat Indian lady, that's me. Because I can kind of pull off a 10-year, like, you know, a 10-year. I look in my early 30s, but, you know, I'm just going to say, hey, I'm just going to own it. Put the hair dye down, and it's like every year I'm like, this year I'm going to stop dying. And then I let an inch grow in and I run for the box. So now you know too much about me. I have a son, Leroy. He's 7, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. But I did go to University of Oregon in Eugene for my undergrad. And unlike many of my friends and family, I loved it there because there's this special brand of, like, white liberalism. I don't know if it's special everywhere, but because it's such a liberal town, and so race doesn't matter, and it's so white, and, you know, I mean, but especially my cousin Natalie, she had so many experiences with her and her daughter, and she's much darker than I am. And I mean, like, here we pump our own gas in California and
yeah,
everywhere
Oregon,
else in the country.
You don't.
No,
yeah.
Except for Oregon and New Jersey. And she's been refused service. I mean, just, you know, stuff that you get, you know, that people of color have these stories to tell, but in Eugene, they were really amplified. And The things that I liked about it were, you know, that I had good experiences there, and Leroy had good friends and the schools. Anyway, and my family was close enough. I don't know what else to say. You know, I went to high school. I graduated in 83, and I went to college at NYU for film and dramatic writing, and I dropped out after a year, and I spent pretty much the next 20 years drinking and
having
temping.
A party.
Yeah. And then I had a baby. And the party was over and it was time to go to school. Yeah, it's not a glamorous story, but it's my story. And it turned out that school was something that I was good at, and I decided that I had something to say in this academic forum, so I'm sticking around. All right, Miguel and Waddell, are you guys done fighting over who's next?
I can go.
All right.
Yeah. So this is Mabel Sar Nirangas, Miguel. So I'm going to start by giving a little background of myself, which will lead into why or how I got here. So I came to the U.S. in 93 for college. And I did a lot of partying and hanging out, got distracted, and then I had a baby in 96. So I stopped going to college and kind of focused on the kid's dad, work, you know. And then I had my second child in 99 and decided that I would help my partner get through college. And so he got his degree in 2000, and then he left and went home in 2001 and left me with the, well, he didn't leave me with the kids, he left and took the kids. I went back and got the kids, and then I've been a single parent ever since. So when I came back to the U.S. With my children, it was very difficult at the time because they were four and one at the time. And, you know, daycare costs and whatnot were too outrageous. So the only other option that was placed before me was to return to school because my schedule is more flexible. So my college education came back into my life in sort of a strange way. I didn't really want to do it, but I ended up having to do it for my children in the most literal sense. And when I went back to Washington State University, which is in Eastern Washington, I went back to my majors, which were political science and history at the time. I ended up dropping poli-sci. It was too brutal for me. I couldn't think out loud. I couldn't speak my mind. And so I just decided to get out of that department and stick to history. But even in history, even though I had a couple allies, my professors, it was very difficult to maneuver in terms of doing the kind of work and asking the kind of questions that I had at that point. And then somehow I stumbled onto the women's studies major. And it was at that point that I ended up pursuing a second degree in that field. So by the time I left Washington State University, I had two degrees, one in history and one in women's studies. But women's studies had really opened me up to the prospect of ethnic studies because many of their courses were cross-listed. And I had no idea what the heck I was getting into when I was applying for grad school. I applied to a couple of women's studies programs in the Midwest, but I was really not interested in moving to the Midwest, and so those were less priorities for me. And then I was left with UC Berkeley, UCSD, and UH, the Pacific Studies, Islander Studies program there. And I ended up choosing UCSD mostly because my brother was stationed here. And I figured, you know, it was high time that I be close to family and be around my people, which I had avoided for, you know, the 10 years that I had been gone from home. I tried to stay away from Palawans because I knew that I love my people and I would end up hanging out with them and perhaps not accomplish what I had set out to do. So anyway, that's what drew me here. And I'm really glad I came here because I met Miguet, who is a Chamorro scholar, very brilliant. And I've learned a lot from him, but from other people too in the department. And my first year was really traumatic because it felt, it was a huge challenge because I didn't really know what to expect, and yet I had expectations of what ethnic studies ought to be. And one of the biggest expectations was that it should be a safe space for people like me to do the kind of work that I wanted. But I quickly learned that this field is also shaped and influenced by dominant ideas of race and ethnicity that doesn't necessarily include indigenous peoples. But that's not a bad thing. I think since I've arrived here, the department has really opened its vision up to be more, I hate to use the word inclusive, but that's sort of the way they're heading. And so they're actually having conversations around indigeneity, which is better than nothing, I guess.
But we don't want to be included.
No, we don't.
we're kind of arguing. I mean, part
right,
of the reason
you're
on the podcast
right.
is that we're asking them to recenter.
Recenter it, right. But I think this was the first step that needed to take place in order
yeah.
for the dialogue to even begin, you know? And so I think it was, you know, I think that happened last year with the three of us being in the department.
It's really the beauty of being in such a small department
yeah.
that people have such an enormous impact. Like the
mm-hmm.
minute that we three found each other, thank you, Madel.
Sorry.
Things started shifting.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
for me personally, but also in the department.
And I really feel that's when Ross felt like there was an outlet. He was like, this is an avenue that I should pursue. And I mean, while it seems like he may be exploiting us as grad students, you know, if people were to
no.
look in, I don't think he is, because I think he saw this as an opportunity. We have the nuts and bolts that we need, and he's there, right there to guide us. You know, I think that if other people were to look in, they would think, oh, he used them, you know. But I don't think so.
Oh, I never, I mean, you know,
I think
share with him stuff. Like, I told him we're doing a podcast, but, you know, you're the one who came up with doing the directed reading on Indigenous epistemologies, and we all had feedback into how that syllabus was going to look.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
But you know what? I'm telling you, if Ross, like, he's pursuing this cluster situation
yeah.
and all these other things that seemingly are coming out, I think that if other people, like, especially faculty in our department, if they were to, you know, kind of look at the big picture, they might think that he's put us up to it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
and I really want to say that he didn't. I think
oh,
a lot
okay.
of this
yeah,
is
no.
has come from
no,
the relationship
mm-hmm.
that we've built and the discussions that we've had, including discussions with Ross. I mean, he's really helped us develop and articulate the things that we've been talking about lately. So I just want to say that whether or not people see it that way, it didn't pan out that way,
yeah.
right?
And in fact, this podcast, I was taking a communications class,
mm-hmm.
and on the first page it said podcast, and I confess to enjoying a podcast every now and then, especially ones about Harry Potter. Hello, MuggleNet people. I'm 41 going on 12 and a half. And then I thought, gosh, we have such great conversations, we should have a podcast, and Ross was nowhere in the room, and...
Yeah.
You know, I told him about it, and I knew he'd be psyched, and he was, but, yeah,
I think it's important
input.
To say that because, you know, especially with things that happened last year with the whole CGS hire situation, when the grad students wrote that letter, the steering committee came back and said, you guys put the students up to this. I'm not kidding you. They told me that directly.
Well, if you need to background on this, listen to go to our blog and listen to part one and two of the first podcast.
Yeah. So So I'm sure those kinds of discussions or thinkings or rumors go around, so I want to just make sure to say it. Interesting. So that's it for now. I mean, I'll talk more about myself later.
Okay, my turn. My name is Michael Lujan Bavacqua, or Miguet, as I'm thankfully known in this department. Let's see. Where do I begin? I'm 26 years old, born on Guam. born on Guam, but raised all over the place. What's it called? My dad had this thing. I don't know if it was conscious or unconscious about...
Just listening.
Oh, okay. Oh. Had this thing about moving every 2 years, so we would constantly move. So we ended up in Africa at one point. We were in Hawaii, California, Oregon, Guam, all over. And so, although people might say that there is no such thing as a like Chamorro, like traditional experience or whatever, like that's, in people's minds, that's not true at all. Like in people's minds, people constantly make claims that there is this experience. It may not be fixed, it may not be fully authentic, but they'll make claims on this and so on. And so because I was constantly moving around, and because my family was Seventh-day Adventist, whereas the majority of Chamorro families are Catholic, like my experiences growing up as Chamorro were very interesting and strange. So like the majority of my generation, I didn't speak Chamorro at all, because I went to a Seventh-day Adventist private school instead of a Guam public school. There was no Guam history curriculum and no Chamorro language curriculum. My grandparents, who are still alive, thank goodness, spoke Chamorro to each other, but never to any of their grandchildren. And so it was a very weird experience growing up on Guam. But then the thing is, now that I look back and think that I was kept from something and everyone else was getting like this great Chamorro experience, I realize that it's unfortunate, but that this like an Americanized experience of Guam is the traditional Chamorro experience on Guam. It is the legacy of U.S. colonization and so on. That those that, like, one of my younger brothers, and he's the only one of us that's still on Guam, he says that really, like, for his, and he's 8 years younger than me, but he says for him, like, the way he imagines, like, the ideal Chamorro, the way the Chamorro really is, it's speaking English, not Chamorro. And so I kind of, so we moved all around. At one point, my parents got divorced, and we moved back to Guam to live with my grandparents. And then when my mom remarried, we moved back to California. And so it was very strange, because on Guam, if I say I'm Chamorro, everyone accepts it and understands it. But then the moment I moved to the States, and I would try to assert that I was a Chamorro, that I was Guamanian, or that I was from Guam, I would get blank faces, quizzed, like, I don't know what the proper adverb is, but kind of quizzingly or whatever, like kind of confused, like, expressions about, well, what is that? And then when I would say what it is, not that I knew that much about what it was, even though I'd grown up there, like, people would constantly look for ask me to produce some sort of cultural difference. So the obvious markers of that are, like, is language, for example. Well, if you're Chamorro, if you're this thing that's different than an American, like, can you prove that you're different by speaking a language that's different? Or what are the markers that you can give me to prove that you're somehow different? And so most Chamorros, when they get into this sort of situation, because you are an invisible minority in the United States, like a big Pacific Islander population, but in terms of the rest of the population, very small, like you tend to like ride the coattails of other more visible ethnic groups. So for young Chamorros in the States, you know, you hardcore identify with like black people, or with like Mexicans, or with Filipinos, and so on. And so it was really strange, like, living that experience, but then knowing it was wrong, but then not really having any knowledge that I could do anything about it. Like, but at some point, I decided to move back to Guam after I had started college to live with my grandparents again. And it was, I mean, I'm really grateful that I did, because that was kind of when I started, like, this path to kind of rethinking my relationship to Chamorro culture, Chamorro history, and so on. And at first, that path is always interesting because it starts as like this idea that there's a root out there. That expression, like, you have to get in touch with your roots. Like, there's a root that's buried somewhere in the sands or the soil of Guam, and you have to dig it up and find it. And then, and that's the framework that everybody starts with. And so you look for it in these particular places. Like, maybe it's in a book, maybe it's in a museum, or maybe there's some piece that I can extract from an elder. And so that's how I started at first, you know, reading books and so on. But as I also started to learn the language by speaking to my grandparents and actually forcing them to speak to me, like, I began to realize that, like, it wasn't so much that I was to be given an object, that my culture was like an object that I would find and, like, therefore take and then pass on to my children and someone else. But it was more like that there was this, like, world, there was this, like, ocean around me, and that my commitment and my love for it was always defined because it was not complete without me. And it's kind of paradoxical, but therefore it's not that, because when I talk about this, it's always from the framework revitalization versus preservation. So that for Indigenous people, a lot of times it's an issue of your language and your culture and your history. It's an issue of preservation. You need, it's dying, it's disappearing, so you need to, like, gather it together and find a place for it where it can remain stable and where it can continue to exist. But then that assumes that it's that object, it's that root, that I'm not really a part of it, I'm just kind of the hands that gather it so it can be passed on in that form to someone else. I'm not supposed to mess with it. It's not really mine. Like, I'm not really part of it at all. I mean, and so for me, that's basically preparing your knowledge, your language for the museum. It is not preparing it for you. Even though you may make claims that it is for you, if your framework is preservation, like, you're not really a part of that. It belongs to someone else. So for me, it's always revitalization, that I protect this because it belongs to me. It's all of ours, and I'm absolutely a part of it. So therefore, I have a place in shaping that culture, in making it, in redefining it, and so on. And so the moment I started thinking about culture in those terms, that's when I really started getting, I guess, radical or political on Guam. And so at the time I was in the University of Guam, which is a very colonial institution, which kind of, unfortunately, it has so much potential because it is the largest educational institution in the Western Pacific. So it is kind of a transit point for people from the other islands in Micronesia, who want to get higher education, they come to the University of Guam, or even in Asia. People from Asia come to the University of Guam to get a U.S. education. It has a lot of potential, but then the faculty that tend to populate it are like the dregs of the United States. They're like the people that can't get hired in the United States, or the people that are looking to, like, for an easy ride, you know, who just want to, like, kick back and think that they'll just become like another beachcomber. And so it's unfortunately those people who fill it. And so going to school there for both undergraduate and graduate, I realized that, like, that there has to be some there, like, because the university on Guam is such a, and even in the States, is such a privileged site of knowledge production and then making of norms and then codifying of histories and so on, determining what's formal, what should be done, what's right, appropriate, etc. I realized that, like, this university, it has to change. If I am committed to the Chamorro people, to Chamorro culture, to, like, to kind of making a future for Guam which isn't attached to, like, the United States, then I have to, like, change this. I have to decolonize this school. And so, I mean, the only way that you can do that, because it is a U.S. institution, is by getting some sort of higher degree, like a PhD. And so, I mean, I asked people where I could do that, while still, where I could get a PhD, but then still do work on, like, Chamorros or Pacific Island stuff, and there wasn't a lot of places in the world, unless you wanted to do, like, museum studies or anthropology. Or something. There wasn't too many places. And then my limits was that it had to be in California, pretty much, because my mom lives in California with most of my siblings. And it couldn't be cold. It could not be cold. So, UMichigan was an option, but hell no.
That was my reason for not
Me too.
We're rejecting that, yeah.
Yeah, who wants to spend all their extra money on a
another
snow
coat.
Boots?
Yeah. So, I mean, I didn't know much about education in the United States, but a couple of my friends who are already in graduate programs said, like, go into ethnic studies. I think in ethnic studies they might let you do Pacific Island stuff. And, I mean, I couldn't find any Pacific Island professors in any of the programs or any focus at all. But still, like I said, well, maybe I can do the work that I want to do there, like, maybe. So I applied and I got in, and I'm glad I came to UCSD. Because although there's no indigenous epistemological or native or Pacific Islander conversation, like, really going on, with the exception of me and Madel, or me and Madel, Angie and Ross.
At the kitchen table.
Yeah. Like, although that's not there, it's kind of given me and then us kind of the opportunity to start that conversation and then bring into it the things that we've experienced, the things that we feel and the things that we want to do. Mm-hmm. And so I know that, although it's difficult, like, that not having that lack has actually kind of produced us as scholars and thinking about issues in really, really good ways. So, I mean, it would have been great to go to the University of Hawaii or something and then, like, be in a class full of Pacific Islanders. But then still, I don't know. This place is okay. It's good. I'm glad I came here.
If you guys hadn't been here, like, I don't know. Well, I mean, I knew that there weren't other Native students here, but I just underestimated how that was going to be, how that would feel, and how... I don't know. I mean, I hope that more, this is the season, you know, for applying. And I know that we all hope that if you're Indigenous and you're an undergrad and you're sending out applications, you know, consider sending one to UCSD, because maybe the things that we're saying don't sound that promising, but actually, you know, there's
potential.
Yeah, there is. There's room. With the mentorship and with just the smallness of the program, I mean, it's not that every cohort and every group, and even that we're in separate cohorts that we got together, like, we're already making an impact, you know? I mean, I wrote a paper for a class that, you know, got passed around a little bit, and I criticized our vision statement, and I'm not saying that's why the vision statement has indigeneity in it this year, but I'm not saying it's not either. I'm saying, like, that these things, you know... That you can have an effect, like, it. I wouldn't say it's a reason, but it certainly must have had an effect, you know, because things are changing, and I don't know. I was thinking about when we were talking about this the other day, like, well, we decided too that we might talk about decolonization today, and Miguel was saying that he doesn't think that a lot of ethnic studies professors maybe think of that there's a real sort of radical potential for change. And to me that is, I don't know if why, but I locate that as an Indigenous, like, idea.
Oh, yeah.
That change is... you know, possible, necessary, happening.
I mean, and it's always happening. It's inevitable. We just have to know how to roll with it, you know, and keep these conversations going within that transformation. You know what I mean? Like, I've always felt like Indigenous people are the most adept at doing that, actually, you know?
Out of necessity.
Well, yeah, but I mean, and also survive. I mean, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
But then obviously, like, well, I'm reading, or I was last night reading a manuscript of Andrea Smith's forthcoming book. I think it's coming out of Duke. Miguel thinks it's coming from UC.
No, I think you're right.
2007, Unlikely Alliances, Native American and Christian Right Organizing, and it's about activism and building coalitions. And this is a this is a coalition, you know, the Native mm-hmm. student and the Pacific Islanders, you know, we got together to, and we're stronger because of it, you know, and it was a necessary thing. And we do it out of necessity and we do it all the time. I don't know what, I love my cohort and I've said it a million times, but I was definitely looking for a way out. I was thinking about applying to law school. I was thinking about taking my LSAT. Yeah, just another. I was thinking about trying to transfer because I thought I had made not a mistake in the department, but just a mistake in how isolated I had become. But then when the school year started and we still had a conversation, like, then I realized that I didn't have to leave. You know, and that was great because I love living in San Diego. I'm getting a lot out of my studies. You know, I don't want to go, but I just didn't think that I could be successful being the only one. You know.
No, that's what makes this department. I mean, good is that even if there's no one that does your stuff, like, it's still possible for you to do your stuff. Like, one of my cousins is at UC Riverside in history, and he a PhD in history, and so he basically, I mean, he wants to do Pacific Island stuff, but he stayed at UC Riverside because he'll finish his PhD faster, because he got his master's there. And so when he talks to his committee about it, basically everyone's like, he's saying, like, I want to do Pacific Islander stuff, I want to do education, colonial education in Guam, and, you know, in the 20th century related to Native American, you know, experiences in colonial education and stuff. And people are like, all his committee is like, oh, that's nice, but I can't be on your committee. I don't do that work. I can't help you.
That's strange. I mean, none of the people on my committee, maybe with the exception of Ross, actually do the same, you know, have any expertise on Pacific Islander or indigenous, well, with the exception of, but they find ways. I mean, I think that's what's great about the faculty in this department is they find other skill sets that they can contribute to our own success, you know, the success in producing the kind of knowledge we're out to produce. And I didn't even know what that was when I first got here. Like, I didn't know what I was going to do. I thought, I'm going to get this PhD, no matter what.
And it's a good attitude to have.
If it means that I have to write a comparative analysis on my experience as a Balaan woman and those of Filipino women, so be it. Right? But luckily,
inside joke.
Yes, inside joke. Luckily, I was able to produce a thesis that I think is true to my interest. And
say the name of the thesis.
Name of my thesis is, I can't remember the title. I think it's Benevolent Illusions.
I can't remember.
Producing narrative liberation narratives on the Republic of Belau. I think that's what it is. I'm not sure.
Title.
Yeah, but, and I was very happy with the outcome. I wrote it from a place that is meaningful, and I think the process was meaningful because there were meaningful conversations that came out of it with Miguet, with all the faculty members on my committee, and even within my cohort when we were doing the classes that you're doing now, Angie. It seemed at that time that this was never going to go anywhere. But they were actually useful conversations that worked out in the end, you know. They may have not been useful at that moment, but later on while I was writing, I was able to use a lot of the conversations that came out of those classes to finish my thesis.
Natalia was just talking about that yesterday.
What?
About how the conversations that we in are that we in... I am from North Portland. Conversations that we were in inform our work so much. And although my cohort is, you know, the work is all over the place, we are, you could put us on a panel. it interlinks. Mm-hmm. You know, she was saying that we're like a chain, you know, and it's true. Like all of us, our work is because we're in the same conversations, you know, it's a, because I will not let go of indigeneity, I think every single person in my cohort is employing some methodological tactics that I consider indigenous, you know, yeah. And it's awesome.
Yeah.
How that is true.
Because it's like really strange, right? Like, did you take that immigration class with us? No, with Natalia?
This is my first class with her.
Okay, so, you know, out of all the classes that I've taken, we took war and history with Yen and
war
all
and
that,
death.
Or war and death. I mean, we've taken, and then we took that class with Mark, right?
Yes.
Out of all the classes, the immigration class actually informed my work the most.
That's
that
awesome.
That makes no sense to me.
It I makes know. No sense. It makes no sense. But it did. And it was because of all the conversations that came out where the ideological framework came out for my thesis. I'm like, what? But it happened. But don't take an immigration or an intro to Asian American history class, you know, thinking that you're going to get some epiphany and write this thesis better. But
well, but I guess, oh, it doesn't make any sense to me, but it makes sense for you because you have to deal with immigration when you come to the United States.
I sure do.
Yeah, whereas I don't. Being a Chamorro, I have...
Well, how lucky of you.
Limited U.S. congressional citizenship.
Privilege and privilege.
Oh, gosh. I get this big old stamp in my passport that says...
You would never find me in an immigration class.
They're like, what are you? I'm a CFAPAL, dude. That's what I am. What is your immigration status? CFAPAL.
What does that mean?
Go ask an immigration officer. They couldn't tell you either. They wouldn't know.
So you aren't naturalized or anything?
No. I might come
first. Oh.
Yeah, I wouldn't take an immigration class either because I just feel like, aren't I in an immigration class? Just being in the Space Department is like being in an immigration class. Oh, no, now we're letting loose a little
inside
bit.
Inside joke.
Sick burn. Wow.
But I know, but I can see it just because right now everyone in my cohort's taking Lisa Lowe's lit class. And I looked at that, but the time wasn't good. And but they're really, everyone in that class, they're getting a lot out of it. She's, they say that she's doing a lot of teaching, you know. Mm. But I think that they're enjoying it because she has so much to say. And because she's, even though it's cross-listed, she's not ethnic studies.
She's Lisa Lowe.
Exactly.
And let's think about your cohort and the
right.
kind of work they do.
Well, yeah.
They're going to, if Lisa Lowe is Lisa Lowe.
Okay, my cohort is, they're...
Bento.
Yeah, we call ourselves the Fist because there's a mighty five of us. But Maget has decided to call us the Bento Box.
Cohort.
Yeah, I'm the big... Meaty.
Only you're the meat and rice. You're the
no,
meat
she's
rice.
The strap that straps all the bento boxes together.
Because, well, gosh, I don't know if they'll want to hear about themselves, but, you know, there's just four others and me, and they can all be described as Asian and Asian American, although they have completely different histories and locations, so.
But it's good that they're supporting you, or that they have dialogues and discussions with you,
yeah,
about indigeneity. Like most, that's one of the problems with a lot of ethnic studies, like food group people.
How is our
is
cohort
that,
group people?
Food group.
The four food
ethnic
groups,
studies.
You know?
All those people.
Yeah,
I didn't come up with the food group thing.
No,
someone
I
else came up, but like most of them won't even go there. They'll just
because
like react
where does
really
the indigenous go? Well,
it's like the napkin on the floor of the table that has the food groups on it.
It's the paper wrapper on the chopsticks,
and
my
every
friend.
Now and then they'll sprinkle some Pacific Islander.
That's good, yeah.
My cohort are they are really like engaged and they're caring and they're interested. I mean, they're all committed, I think, to radical scholarship in ways that, you know, because we are talking, you know, they do listen to me and then contribute and ask really important questions that push me to answer them for myself. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they aren't dismissive at all. They're more like, what do you mean? How do we do that? We were talking about our master's thesis drafts and because of something I said, you know, somebody changed, you know, their intro to include like a piece saying like, because I said, I don't know if you need this. I said, I'm always interested if I'm reading scholarship, especially that I really enjoy a text. I always want to know why is the person writing it? And, you know, what's their relation to it? And at this point, Natalia called me a stalker. And I was like, yeah, I am. I'll be Googling. Be like, why are they writing that? And so she, you know, she wrote a piece about why she was doing the work, which, you know, I had no idea up to that point. We've been talking about it now for over a year. And I don't know whether she'll keep it in or not. But, yeah, we really have a lot of respect for each other. And we're getting together tomorrow. I don't know. I get choked up sometimes thinking about how much support. Like, because I know that before I came here or to grad school, like people say, oh, your cohort can really get you through. But I didn't really understand how that was possible, you know, how you could have those kind of like intense ties with people who weren't your family or mm-hmm. chosen friends, how people who are just, you go to class together, you know, could. But I guess because like what you produce seems to be so intimately connected to who you are. And when you're sharing that with people, like you create bonds. The other day in class, we were talking about these pieces that we're doing. And, you know, I copy certain things that other people might like, structure, tactics, you know, mm-hmm. studying things from other people in my cohort. But I don't know what this has to do with indigeneity, except, you know, that I always feel kind of like a mess compared to them, you know, like I'm the napkin on the floor, you know, like I'll call my own, you know, yeah, at some point this person in my court got up to the board and he started basically like outlining my work, like, okay, here's this, and somebody needed to do it, you know, and I wasn't getting there, and I found it, you know, like just the being able to like throw a hand out and say, here, you know, but I don't get treated like I feel like the caboose on the train. But they don't treat me that way.
Right.
You know. But that's, I don't know. I was talking to Jose about the, you know, recruiting for next year and looking at the new, and I was like, you know, you've got to, when you look at them, like, try to move some indigenous people into that stack. Is this making sense what I'm saying to people who don't know what I'm saying? When we're talking about, like, people applying to our department. And how I'm hoping that some indigenous names get through in recruiting. And I was like, you know, I'm just saying, like, they might not be, and I mean, is this just a terrible thing to say, but they might not be, like, the beacons, of the shining ones, you know, in the pile. And I don't want to, like, put down anybody, but I don't know. Is that just, I mean, I know that you wrote this paper, like, saying that we do it to ourselves, like, we... I mean, you're talking about Chamorros, but how we put ourselves down, like, oh, we're not as good as other people, or that's just, you know, the Chamorro way, you know.
Mm.
Chamorros do that? Actually, they think they're better than everybody else. But little do they know.
You sound like the people who send the
Little
email.
Do they know
oh, no.
that the sovereign country of Palau.
Just kidding. It's jokes.
No, but that's one of the problems... With how, I don't know, I don't like the way that people tend to pick who comes into departments, yeah. especially when you're a big department, because then it's just, a lot of times it's just trends. It's just how well someone can speak, like, use intersectionality or use whatever. Well, no, hybridity's not anymore, but it used to be, like, if you trotted out hybridity and stuff, you would be like, whoa, this kid sounds cutting edge, whoa. But It's that same thing. And so the problem is, if you look at like people that are coming from like Asian American studies or like American studies, yeah. Like, so they'll have that lingo, right? Especially for our department, because our department is very closely linked to the Association of Asian American Studies and the American Studies Association. So if those, whatever's cutting edge in those fields, like, will kind of dictate, like, you know, whatever we're going to look for in the pile. And so, unfortunately, like, Native American programs, people who come from University of Guam or from wherever, like, I didn't use any buzzwords, probably, in my thing, except for so maybe decolonization. How you got
chosen. I mean, I've always
overwhelmed them with my masculinity.
That works every time. But I've been always curious to know how I was allowed to. I mean, I'm not the smartest person, and if you look at my if you look at my paperwork, I mean, I would throw my paperwork back in the stack and be like, next. You know, I probably didn't stand out, so I'm always interested to find out how. It had to be my name. It was just so long. It took up all this space, and they're like, whoa, this woman. Or they probably didn't even know I was a woman. They're like, this person is somebody, because their name's like 15 alphabet. I don't know. I'm just curious.
No, I think we both got in because, you know, to bring in Pacific Islanders into the department. I'm pretty sure that's why.
Why would they bring in people, though, when they don't have any Pacific Islander faculty?
Well, for our department.
Or if you build it they will come? Oh,
yeah. Yeah, right. But that's exactly true. If you build it, they will come. I think that's true.
I mean, the department is trying to address its deficiencies, but then the problem is if you don't pick a food group or if you don't pick something specific, then you're going to end up trying to bring in, like, all of these people. So, like, everyone this year is, like, need more, so indigenous epistemology, need someone who does that, need someone who does queer theory, need more African-Americanists, need more. And the problem is that ethnic studies, because it doesn't have, like, a stable, specific community or discipline or, like,
center,
something like that, yeah, because it doesn't have that, so it will respond to all of these things, mm-hmm. So it'll try and bring them all in. So there was a deficiency, like no Pacific Islanders.
I mean, did that deficiency just become visible all of a sudden? I mean, there's been that deficiency for a freaking long time.
Well, I mean,
so why that year? I mean, that's what I'm
if I had to guess, I mean, look at Michigan. Has they worked hard to get a small group of Pacific Islander faculty, tried to bring in Pacific Islander students, haven't really been able to.
Yeah, they rejected me.
Michigan.
And then Berkeley the year before.
Rejected.
Yeah, but the year before we came in, they brought in three.
Oh, that's right. So we couldn't have gotten in again because they already have three. That's just going above the quotas, Miguel. And they already had a Miguel. Not to mention
that had three leave, though. Oh, really? Yeah, when I went to visit Berkeley, they had three out of that cohort and were already gone. So
poor Berkeley. Oh. I feel sorry for them being on the top. So I hope that they can kind of. Okay, 5 more minutes.
We'll do 5 more minutes and then do the second one.
Okay.
Oh, okay. After.
I mean, I don't know that people want to listen to us for 2 hours straight.
It's going to be divided up into segments.
Give people a break.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do 5 more minutes.
Okay. No, but I hope that they do bring in. And I hope that people start to see past, like, that. The flashiness of someone who knows, like, the buzzwords and the lingo. To someone who is more committed to their project. I mean, because to me that's more important, is if someone's committed to their project or to a community, then someone who can just kind of throw the words around.
Well, we don't know them too well yet.
To know
the new difference. Cohort, though, seems to have some really, like, dedicated, you know, mm-hmm. interesting people in it. And they're nice and big, so they'll probably bring their own changes.
There's 7 of them?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, is that? That just seems big if you're only 5.
No, it's big. I mean, we're 9.
It's not as big as our 9.
Yeah. I think we're going to be the biggest cohort here on out, folks. They're never going to bring that many of us in because we turned the department upside down for a little bit there.
Yeah. So. Oh, but it's good. It's good to tear things up. Ethnic studies cannot be a safe space. It can be a productive space. It can be a space where you make great work and where you work with people, and it's good like that, but it can never be the place where...
Well, and then I think we need to define what safe means, because that's going to be different for different people. And what I thought was an ideal safe space is probably different than probably our other cohort and what they thought.
I think as long as we live in this world that people of color, you know... and academia, like, we're not gonna, or anywhere really, we're not, you know, gonna find that.
I have a safe space.
You do?
Yeah.
Bollywood.
No, that too.
No, I'm interested in this. With your advisors and the people you've chosen to work with and the work that you've chosen to do, like, you can truly call that?
Oh, no, I'm not calling that a safe space. I'm saying I have a safe space. Oh, okay.
You have a special happy place.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, okay. Oh, that's different then.
Yeah. No, but then that's where I can read and write, and then it's there. It's just in that space.
Okay. But anyway. So I guess we'll end this one for now. Wow, we talked about a lot of good stuff.
We had a good one. Let me say that to comment on this or any of our other podcasts, you can go to our blog.
Voicing
Indigeneity.
Voicingindigeneity.blogspot.com.
Yeah. Or you can email directly.
At mlbasquiat@hotmail.com.
Please share your comments, feedback. We'd love to hear from you.
We have 3 subscribers, you guys.
No,
We do. Got 3 subscribers.
Awesome.
On our feed burner. All right. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.